You know, there are missions in wartime that change the shape of history, and then there are missions that probably shouldn't have worked at all. I'm Tail Dragger, and this is The Hangar on Radio Hangar, and today, I want to tell you about one morning in the South Pacific that was equal parts chess match and long odds gamble. April 18, 1943, 16 Army Air Corps fighters launched on a mission so secret that most of the pilots didn't know the target until they were already strapped in. Pull up a chair for this one. It's a story about codebreakers dead reckoning over open ocean and the longest fighter intercept of the entire war. Today's show is brought to you by AviationSoul.com, aviation challenge coins for every milestone in flight. First solo, private pilot, instrument rating, all the way up. If you've earned it, they've got a coin for it. Every coin tells a story. Check them out at AviationSoul.com. So let's set the scene. By the spring of 43, the United States had been slugging it out in the Solomon Islands for the better part of a year. Guadalcanal had been secured, but the Japanese were still dangerous, still organized, and still led by one of the sharpest military minds of the 20th century, Admiral Isoroku Yamamoto. He was the architect of the Pearl Harbor attack, he was the commander of the combined fleet, and the American intelligence community knew exactly where he was going to be on the morning of April 18th because they had broken the Japanese naval code. Now here's where it gets interesting. Navy codebreakers out of Station Hypo in Pearl Harbor intercepted a message on April 14th that laid out Yamamoto's itinerary in precise detail. He was going to fly from Rabaul to Bougainville to inspect forward air units. The message included departure times, arrival times, the number of aircraft in his party, and even the type of airplane he'd be riding in, a Mitsubishi G4M, which the Americans called a Betty bomber, two of them, in fact, with an escort of six Mitsubishi A6M0s. That intercept landed on the desk of Admiral Chester Nimitz. And Nimitz had a decision to make that went all the way up to the Secretary of the Navy, Frank Knox, and almost certainly to President Roosevelt himself, though that was never officially confirmed. The question was simple and terrible. Do we assassinate the enemy's most important military leader? The arguments against were real. If you shoot down Yamamoto, you tip the Japanese off that their codes are broken, that intelligence advantage, the ability to read enemy communications in near real time, was arguably more valuable than killing any single officer. There was also the question of who would replace him. Yamamoto was brilliant, yes, but he was also a realist. He'd opposed the war with America from the beginning. His replacement might be less competent, but more fanatical. In the end, the decision came down in favor of the mission. Kill Yamamoto now the problem. Yamamoto's flight path took him to an airfield at Bale near the southern tip of Bougainville. The closest American fighter base was on Guadalcanal, at Henderson Field. That's over 400 statute miles each way. In 1943, there was exactly one American fighter with the range to make that round trip. The Lockheed P-38 Lightning. I love this airplane. Twin booms, twin Allison V-1710 engines, center nacelle with the pilot sitting between two supercharged 12-cylinder power plants that together put out about 3,000 horsepower. It was fast, it climbed well, and with drop tanks, it had legs, but 400 miles out and 400 miles back, at low altitude to avoid Japanese radar, burning extra fuel the whole way, that was pushing even the Lightning to its limit. The mission was assigned to the 339th Fighter Squadron of the 347th Fighter Group, operating out of Henderson Field. Major John Mitchell was the flight leader. He was a quiet, methodical pilot from Mississippi, and he was handed the hardest navigation problem any fighter pilot had faced in the war. Think about what Mitchell had to do. He had to lead 16 P-38s on a circuitous route that swung wide to the west, over open water, staying below 50 feet to avoid detection. No radio communication, no navigation aids, no radar of their own. Just a compass, a watch, and a set of course headings that Mitchell had worked out the night before on a map and a plotting board. They would fly legs of varying distance and heading, essentially a series of doglegs over featureless ocean, and arrive at a precise intercept point at a precise time to catch Yamamoto's flight as it descended toward Balale. Dead reckoning, over the Pacific.
In a fighter. For 2 hours, I've flown long cross countries where I've sweated the navigation with a moving map and GPS and a glass panel full of data, and I've still managed to second-guess myself. Mitchell did it with a compass and a clock over water that looked exactly the same in every direction. The 16 Lightnings launched just after 0700 local time. Four were designated the killer flight. Their job was to go after Yamamoto's bomber. The other 12 were the cover flight. They would climb to altitude and engage the Zero escorts. The killer flight was led by Captain Thomas Lanfear Jr. and included 1st Lieutenant Rex Barber, 1st Lieutenant Besby Holmes, and 1st Lieutenant Ray Hine. They flew at wavetop height, and I mean wavetop, 50 feet above the swells, throttled back to save fuel. Props set for long-range cruise, each pilot watching the back of the airplane ahead of him and trying not to think about how far they were from anything friendly. Saltwater spray on the windscreens. The drone of those Allisons filling the cockpit for 120 minutes straight. Then Holmes had a problem. His drop tanks wouldn't feed properly. He couldn't transfer fuel, which meant he was going to come up short on the way home. He stayed in formation, but the kill flight was effectively down to three aircraft. Mitchell's navigation was nearly perfect. After 2 hours of overwater dead reckoning, they made landfall exactly where they were supposed to, turned northwest, and began their run toward the intercept point. And right on schedule, Mitchell spotted them. Two Betty bombers and six Zeros descending toward Balale at about 4,500 feet. The timing was almost eerie. Mitchell had intercepted a flight 400 miles away, using nothing but math and a wristwatch, and arrived within 1 minute of the predicted contact time. What happened next took about 3 minutes, and the details have been argued for 80 years. Lanfear and Barber dropped their external tanks and climbed to intercept. The Zero saw them coming and peeled off to engage. One of the Betty bombers dove for the jungle canopy, trying to get low and disappear. The other turned hard toward the coast. Lanfear later claimed he shot down the first Betty, the one carrying Yamamoto. But Rex Barber told a different story. Barber said he pursued the lead Betty into the treetops, closing to within 50 yards, hammering it with his 450 caliber machine guns and the 20mm cannon in the Lightning's nose. He watched pieces fly off the right engine, saw the bomber's wings shear away, and saw it cartwheel into the jungle. The second Betty was shot down over the water. Its passengers, including Yamamoto's chief of staff, Vice Admiral Motomi Ugaki, survived. Ugaki was pulled from the wreckage with injuries. He would go on to lead kamikaze operations in the final months of the war. Ray Hine was the only American loss. His P-38 was hit during the engagement and went down over the water. They never found him. The controversy over who actually killed Yamamoto festered for decades. Lanfear was loud about his claim. Barber was quieter but insistent. The Air Force initially credited Lanfear, then decades later changed the official record to a shared credit between Lanfear and Barber, which satisfied nobody. Most modern historians, after examining Japanese crash site evidence and reconstructing the flight paths, believe Barber fired the shots that brought down Yamamoto's bomber. The wreckage was found in the jungle the next day by a Japanese search party. Yamamoto was still in his seat, thrown clear of the fuselage but still strapped in, his white-gloved hand resting on the hilt of his sword. He had been hit by two 50 caliber rounds, one through the shoulder, one through the jaw. He was dead before the airplane hit the trees. The Japanese kept his death secret for over a month. They couldn't explain how the Americans had found him, and they were terrified that their codes had been compromised, which of course they had been. The Americans played it cool, no press releases, no victory laps. The mission stayed classified until well after the war, specifically to protect the code-breaking secret. Now, the moral weight of this mission is worth sitting with for a minute. This was a targeted assassination, not a battlefield engagement, not a bombing raid on a military installation. The United States military identified one man, planned his killing with surgical precision, and sent pilots 400 miles to execute him. There's a reason it was called Operation Vengeance. The name was deliberate. Yamamoto had planned Pearl Harbor, and this was the answer. Whether it shortened the war is debatable. Yamamoto's replacement, Admiral Minichi Koga, was competent enough but lacked Yamamoto's strategic vision. Some historians argue that Yamamoto alive might have pushed for a negotiated peace sooner. Others say his death shattered Japanese naval morale at a critical moment. What's not debatable is that the mission itself was a masterpiece of planning, navigation, and execution. John Mitchell flew a 400-mile dead-reckoning intercept over open ocean and arrived within 60 seconds of the target. Rex Barber closed to point-blank range on a diving bomber in the jungle canopy and shot it out of the sky. 16 P-38s flew a mission at the absolute limit of their fuel endurance, and 15 came home. Back when Avgas was cheap and airspace was free, we didn't have GPS. We didn't have moving maps, and we didn't have flight management systems that could plot an intercept to the second. John Mitchell had a chart, a compass, a clock, and the kind of quiet confidence that comes from knowing your airplane and trusting your math. Every time I hear a pilot say they can't fly without their iPad, I think about Mitchell over the Solomons, 50 feet above the water, with the fate of an empire riding on his heading indicator. The P-38 Lightning itself deserves a moment of respect here. That airplane was designed by Clarence Kelly Johnson at Lockheed when he was barely 30 years old. It was radical. Twin engines on a single-seat fighter, tricycle gear, counter-rotating propellers that eliminated torque on takeoff.
It could do 400 miles per hour in level flight. It could carry enough fuel to fly missions that no other American fighter could touch. Charles Lindbergh flew P-38s in the Pacific and taught combat pilots how to lean their mixtures for range, getting an extra hour of endurance out of those Allisons. Richard Bong, America's top ace with 40 confirmed kills, flew a P-38 for every single one of them. Tommy McGuire, number 2 with 38, same airplane. The Lightning wasn't perfect. It compressed badly in high-speed dives, and the early models had a nasty tendency to tuck under at high Mach numbers. Pilots died learning the limits. But for the Pacific Theater, where distances were vast and you might fly for hours over nothing but blue water before the fight even started, there was nothing else like it. Yamamoto's death was confirmed publicly by the Japanese on May 21, 1943, more than a month after the mission. His ashes were returned to Tokyo aboard the super battleship Musashi. He was given a state funeral. The emperor himself attended. Rex Barber flew more combat missions after Vengeance. So did John Mitchell. Neither man talked much about April 18th for a long time. Mitchell once said the hardest part wasn't the flying. It was the waiting, sitting in a ready tent on Guadalcanal the night before, knowing what they were about to do, and knowing that nobody could ever know they'd done it. That's the thing about the great missions in aviation history. The pilots who fly them often carry the weight in silence. The airplane has no opinion about what it's being asked to do. It doesn't know if it's carrying mail, or bombs, or the fate of an admiral. It just burns fuel and holds a heading. The human in the seat is the one who has to live with the rest of it. If you want to dig deeper into Operation Vengeance, I'd point you to Lightning Strike by Donald Davis, and the Air Force Historical Studies Office has the declassified mission reports that are well worth reading. The story today came from those sources, some good primary accounts from the pilots themselves, and a few decades of hangar flying about the P-38. Find us at radiohangar.com. 15 P-38s out, 15 home, one heading, one clock, one chance to get it right. That's flying.